Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. Welcome to Afternoons with me. I'm Bill Arnold. I'm awfully glad to be joined in the studio today for Guy Talk with Tiger McClune and Dr. Peter Kapsner. Tiger is with Youth Ministries Consultant, and Peter, you know him well, so he needs very little introduction. We're going to open up the phone lines today, and when I say phone lines, I mean text line, and that number is 877-933-2484. We're going to take any question you have. We're going to be looking at it from the guy angle, so if you've got a question about anything, let us know. We'll try to work it out as best we can. We've got some good brain power here in the studio, and we will tackle your question. Again, the number is 877-933-2484. Tiger's been involved in youth ministry for over 35 years, so he knows the kid part of the church. And if you have any questions about youth life, we'd be happy to take that. Peter will take anything, and I will direct the questions. So that's what's ahead. Let's take 60 seconds and then get on with Guy Talk.
Find new inspiration and hope when you read the ESV Gospel Transformation Study Bible, designed to present all of the Bible as a unified message of God's grace and to help you apply this message to your everyday life. You'll find gospel-centered study notes and introductions to each book. Allow your heart to be transformed by the good news on every page of the Gospel Transformation Study Bible. We're giving away one copy each week this month. Enter to win at MyFaithRadio.com.
I'm a regular listener and supporter. We love your show. You're doing a good job, and I try to listen every day. So God bless you. Thanks again. God bless you.
Share your story of how Faith Radio has impacted your life when you call the toll-free Faith Line at 877-93-FAITH. Leave a message anytime at 877-933-2484. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to the show. It is 6 minutes after the hour. We're just getting started. It's Guy Talk today in hour one. The amazing and beautiful queens of the round table will be in hour two. We love having lots of very candid discussion. Anything about the faith, the scriptures, about your family life, about relationships, we're going to try to look at it today from a guy perspective. I have in studio Tiger McClune, who is with Youth Ministries Consultant. He's been involved with youth ministry for over 35 or 40 years. Tiger, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's good to be here.
Thank you so much. And he lives in Lindstrom, Minnesota, where there was a black bear sighting. He was the last person in the studio to know that today. We all knew it except you. And yeah. You live there. What's up with you?
I left early this morning, and apparently I didn't listen to the news today.
Yeah, just so you know, when you get back, there's a bear in your neighborhood. And I'm also joined by Dr. Peter Kapsner. And Peter, it's so nice to have you here.
Great to be back in studio, away for a little bit like that, and it's fun to see your face here again.
Thank you. Last time you called in, you were in Scotland.
Yeah, it was a great trip over there. Yeah, we have some really dear friends. And it's one of those things when you travel overseas and you have Christian friends in another country, it just sort of reminds you how big this beautiful story is. You know, it really is. And it's you see you're part of a bigger kingdom, and that countries do matter. But at the end of the day, our allegiance is to an eternal kingdom. And so we experienced some of that overseas.
Yeah. And now you got your degree over there, didn't you?
I did,
PhD?
Yeah, I crammed my four-year program into 7 years over there.
Nice.
So yeah,
it took
just a little bit of time.
Yes. And so, you graduated, and I saw your graduation picture. You had a kilt on, so
yeah,
I'll just leave it at that.
I do not believe you have that blackmail material in your possession, Bill.
I do. There's a price on that picture if you want to get it out of circulation. Yes, yes. All right, a couple of questions I want to just get started with. Are you bugged by the expression real men? When you hear that expression, real men, and then whatever, fill in the blank, do you start feeling bugged? Or are you okay with that?
I guess I'm never quite sure what the agenda behind real men is.
Okay.
Is it fake men? Is it artificial men is the other option? I don't know. But Sometimes they're just not sure what the agenda is behind that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there seems to be sort of this macho measuring stick that is present when somebody uses that phrase "real man," right? And it's I don't know if it's there's the sort of stoic stubbornness about it. I don't know if it's that you have an ability to just power through or that you succeed or something along those lines. But I think it does. And Tiger, I'd be curious, even with your young people too, there gets to be sort of this measuring stick that we think we have to live up to be a real man. And I don't know anybody that ever walked around and said, hey, I'm a real man. And I think we're all feeling like we fall short.
Well, do you see masculinity being attacked everywhere?
I think so. I think a lot of times I see in media and stuff, the men are the stupid ones in the room who are bumbling along, unaware of relationships, unaware of feelings, just going to impress other people. And that's over stereotype, but I see that kind of sort of caricature a lot, that men are just kind of out of touch with most things. And that's a recurring theme, I think.
Yeah, it seems like it's sort of the one punching bag in our culture and on TV shows or in movies that men really can be sort of the safe punching bag, I suppose, as it were. And I don't know if it's a reaction to what I think is relatively legitimate, that it's tended to be the white male that have held offices of power in our country. And so I don't know if there's a reaction to that that's coming out of a place of anger and bitterness that would, I guess, on many levels be understandable. But and you and I, Bill, have talked about this a number of times. When we try to bring a remedy to something, are we actually doing more damage sometimes than the problem itself? And I think in the pulling down or the deconstructing of the male that's happening all the time, are we going to be creating more issues for the future as opposed to saying, is there a different means to reconcile what has been a difficult relationship between men and women in our country?
It seems if you look at a lot of TV commercials, it's like the woman is always smarter than the man, the kids are always smarter than the woman, and the dog is always the smartest of all of them.
Absolutely. It's so true, right? And I mean, I think you watch any of the main movies that come out, I mean, there was this big girl power moment in the Avengers movie that I think a lot of people saw as potentially contrived for that. I just saw the live-action Aladdin movie, and there's the most significant sort of single character scene was that of Jasmine the princess and her moment of power when she was going to go up against Jafar. And I think you, from Katniss Everdeen and Hunger Games, there's really been about a five-year run where it's been the female has been featured as the main person in power, and the men are anywhere between sort of neutral to maybe dumb in those situations tends to be the common theme.
Mm-hmm. So if masculinity is attacked, are men more or less accountable than they were maybe 15 or 20 years ago?
I do think the positive shifts have held men more accountable for the kinds of things that we just talked about in terms of the misuse of power, we can't hide behind that as much, and some of us don't like that. Some of us men, we still want to be able to have that safe zone. I would say we're more accountable. There's still more accountability that maybe we could be, because men do continue to operate as if they own the power grid, and that they believe that's their right. And you see it a lot in either personal relationships or even in job performance. And, you know, as much as I think the in the media, the opportunities for women to show those power moments have been there, but statistically, it's still the male lead has most of those. And in all the other Avenger movies, it was the male leads predominantly. And so I think we're moving towards being held more accountable, and that's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. If you were to say one of the hallmarks of a real man is, and then you were going to fill in the blank, would accountability jump right to the top of the list?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of what you're accountable for, would jump to the top of the list. And I think an understanding of using whatever power or position or title that you might have for the benefit of other people would be an accountability place that I would invite men to that still do, as Tiger said, hold positions of power in so many different arenas. It's not bad to hold a position of power. The question is what do you do with that power once you have it? And I think there's a lot of people in power, men in particular, that continue to hoard it inwardly as opposed to using that power on behalf of other people.
Accountability is one word that pops into my head. The word that popped in my head right after you asked that question is authenticity.
Okay. I can fake that.
Yeah, I think that's a quality that I would argue needs to be addressed certainly for men. If we're talking about men in particular, I think all people, but Men have played behind a lot of facades, whether it's macho facade or power facade or whatever. And I think authenticity, the next generation is looking for authenticity and authentic people, authentic relationships, authentic faith that's not contrived. And I think authenticity is a quality that we men have to take on as a serious goal in our own lives.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that because I love that word, and it's great. But what does it look like? What are some components of it if we were to dissect it a little bit?
Yeah, for me, I think authenticity is, again, asking is what I'm, how I'm operating and how I'm relating to people, really who I am, really the values I hold, or is it some fake veneer I've tried to create? And authenticity is difficult because it'll mean that I'm weaker than I might look in the public world. I make more mistakes than my facade would look like. And I think we have authenticity is scarier, but I think it's in the long run the only way marriages last. It's the only way relationships with parents and kids last. It's the only way friendships last. And yet, I'm not sure a lot of men have a lot of models of authenticity.
Is it because men are too busy presenting imposters to the world in an effort to succeed or to gain an advantage or to be seen in some light?
Yeah, I think so. I think a real pervasive characteristic for many men is a feeling of insecurity that they really don't have what it takes to do life at all. And so sort of the way you deal with insecurity is to put up a false facade that pretends that you are competent, that you do have sort of the mental, intellectual, whatever you need for your job or for your family, you can sort of fake your way through it. And so I think, what does it mean to have a security of the soul that allows you to then be authentic with your failings? And when you first started talking, Bill, about this subject, I had the Apostle Paul in mind when he was saying, you know, I have this treasure in this earthen vessel that I know that the power comes from God and not from myself. And it makes me ask a question. What kind of interior world did Paul have that he was secure in something, obviously, that allowed him to be able to say, hey, look, the power comes from God here, not from me. And I'm fine being weak in this because then I'll be strong. And some of that language, I think, is really different than the language of this world, in which you really do have to always perform on your job. I mean, think about it. If you went into your boss and said, you know, I'm really terrible at these three or four different things, it's probably not going to go over very well. You sort of have to hide your failures and where you fall down in order to put on a good performance so you can get the job, get the relationship, get whatever it is. There's not a real invitation to authenticity in that.
No, we're going to need to talk about this some more. We're going to take a break. We're doing Guy Talk this hour. Let us know what questions you have or issues you would like us to grapple with. We'll do our very best. I'm in studio with Tiger McLuhan and Dr. Peter Kapsner. That number to call is 877-933-2484. I mean text, 877-933-2484. Be back in 90 seconds. Let us know what questions you want us to talk or issues you'd like us to grapple with. It is Guy Talk this hour. Tiger McLuhan's in studio, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and myself, 877-933-2484 is the text line. We'd love to get your questions or your input. We're talking just about this expression, real men. And right before we went to break, Peter, you were making some great points. I wished I would have listened to them so I could remember them. But one of the things I thought when I was listening to you is, what happens when you get older and taking risks starts to get too scary because you don't want to fail?
Yeah, I mean, because you do sort of build up a lifetime, right, of different things.
Well, you were talking about the imposter, and you want to get the job and get the relationship, and you can't go in and say to your boss, I'm really not very good at these three things.
Yeah, absolutely not. And especially if you've got a mortgage or you have, you know, some kids that you're providing for, whatever it all is. You're so right. And my wife Hallie and I were just chatting about some different opportunities ahead of us in the year ahead that are similar to some risks that we took when we were 30, 32, 33. But at 48 years old right now, we're like, huh, you know, maybe the sofa and Netflix looks good again tonight.
Right.
And so it's a much trickier situation because of that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that admitting weakness is any easier when you're younger, because the younger, you're really posturing to try to prove yourself. Your reasons for being an imposter are different when you're older, But I think all of us have struggled just saying, you wouldn't, at early in your career, you're not going to do it because you want the promotion, you want the security of the job. You're not going to go in and say, I'm bad at that. So there's different reasons why I think we cover. And part of it is the image of real men. Part of it is just the reality of risk-taking. I mentioned last time I was on that three rules I learned growing up in an alcoholic family is don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. You don't talk about stuff. We never learned it by a seminar. We just learned it by experience. You don't talk about the stuff. You just wake up tomorrow and pretend like it didn't happen. And you don't trust people, and then you don't try not to feel the feelings when you're confused 11-year-old. You just start to don't deal with it. And I carried that into my early Christian adult leadership, and what I found was the church loved me for that because I was not a whiner. I didn't complain. I didn't talk about my feelings. I was my not trusting people came off as false confidence. So I pretended that I had it all figured out, and I found affirmation for that to the point where I was affirmed to the point where I almost lost everything. I crashed and burned because I couldn't sustain it. You don't build a marriage by don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. I learned that after I got married. My wife kind of had to have a talk with me. That's not going to work. And yet that's all I knew. And what I was really surprised by was no one caught it. I thought they might, but no one caught it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you had to put on the work pants.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And I seemed to fake it pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, Tiger, when you talk like that, too, just about an alcoholic family, I think many of us have been burned relationally, maybe not as severe as an alcoholic family, but you get burned enough in life, and you do sort of learn this way of doing life that is to not trust entirely. And I think about Christian small groups that I'm sometimes in, and you're either polishing up whatever you've been doing over the last couple weeks as you're checking in around the circle, or if you do dare to say something that's not going so well, everybody kind of shuts down because you're not actually in relationship well enough with the people. And so suddenly it's too much information, and somebody says, well, I'll pray for you, and you kind of move on at that point. And so what does it mean to have the kind of friendship in which you could try? I don't know many men that have, especially at ages 40, 50, 60, 70 years old, that I would say have good friends that it's not too much information in the moment. You're really doing life together, and you're saying, hey, this is really troubling to me right now. I'm really failing at this because mostly I'm in kind of this pseudo-comparative game when we're doing the check-in at the Sunday small group.
I think we're back to that authenticity issue, that authentic word, because you're right. We're way better in the Christian world talking about a sin in my past that I conquered that I can talk about victory, not a struggle I'm presently in that I don't have a solution for yet.
Right.
That's a lot harder to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, so so we tend to polish our past failures because now we can talk about them as past tense.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, right now I'm more confused than confident.
And that's pretty powerful.
It is.
If you can say that.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a phrase that I'm working on a book called Confidently Confused. How to be confident in the promises of Scripture while admitting this side of heaven, we're kind of see through a glass darkly, Paul talks about, and we don't quite get it.
Mm-hmm.
There are just some things I'm not going to figure out.
Yeah.
And I've learned to be, maybe I'm getting old enough to just go, I'm okay with that. I've been to seminary and have some, try to use some theological words now and then, but bottom line is sometimes I just don't get it. And authenticity allows us to make that statement without feeling like we are a failure. As a believer.
Yeah, and I think it's freeing to so many people when a person who, like you, or somebody who's a teacher, or somebody who's in pastoral authority is willing to say that on some level and say, hey, look, I'm giving you my best shot at this deal, but, maybe I would say something like, I believe in the authority of Scripture, but my interpretation of Scripture, maybe I'm missing some of it. And to be in that place, then I think can be really freeing, not just for you as a person, but for the people listening. You're not in always a sort of posturing back and forth. There's an awareness that says, hey, some of this stuff's pretty confusing and I may not get it until the other side.
So it sounds like brokenness is pretty essential in this faith journey.
Let's start with brokenness is real.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a reality. Sin is part of our brokenness. Our own experiences have broken parts to them. Our reality have pieces that are mismatched sometimes. So, I think brokenness is simply a real part of the human condition that when we post up on Facebook or Instagram, we don't talk about because the pictures always look really good there. Then we can compare our real mess to the illusion of polished reality in everybody else's world. And then we always come up feeling inferior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I heard a sermon about maybe 20, 29 years ago now that'll stick with me for a lifetime, clearly, if it's stuck with this long. And the pastor is going through the first beatitude in Matthew 5, which says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God." And he went into that phrase, poor in spirit, and he said, you know what this really means is blessed are those that are broken. And he literally used that language. He said, blessed are those who know they don't have what it takes. Because when you go into that place of acknowledging that you actually don't have what it takes, the kingdom begins to unfold to you. You realize you need something bigger than yourself. You need to be part of a bigger story than yourself. And so it's happy are the broken, happy are those that know they don't have what it takes, because the kingdom begins to unfold for them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Here's a question from a listener. Sometimes it seems like my doubt is more real than my faith. Would it be biblical for me to say that God does not want me to struggle with my doubt and fight it on my own? Rather, he wants me to simply believe him and leave the doubt with him.
Mm. Yeah, you know, doubt's a funny thing, isn't it?
No.
And we talked a couple of weeks ago, too, just about the idea that they were in that Matthew passage there, and with the resurrected Jesus on the hillside ready to ascend into heaven, it said that everybody was worshiping, but some were doubting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I sometimes think, gosh, if I was just there 2,000 years ago, I'd never doubt again. And yet, clearly, the people that were there 2,000 years ago, they would doubt. And the scripture, thankfully, doesn't call us to be intellectually certain about our faith as the remedy to our doubts that we're probably going to carry for a lifetime, but that in the midst of the doubt, there is something that is deeper and stronger that does persist called faith, and it's a gift that you're given when you say yes to Jesus and when you lean into it and say, hey, despite my uncertainty and despite the fact that I'm confused, as Tiger said, and despite all of these things, I am going to surrender my life to you, Jesus, that you get this sort of gift of faith that persists in the midst of the doubt. And so I think if somebody is honest, you'll never be done with the doubt from an intellectual standpoint. There are questions that are troubling that we've talked about that will never maybe be resolved, but it's in the midst of those doubts that there's a certainty of the soul that persists that is the cure to the doubt. It isn't, gosh, I finally got the right answer from this latest apologetic book that solved everything.
Yeah.
And so the answer in the biblical text to doubt is a certainty of faith from the soul, not from intellectual certainty.
Yeah. Tiger, when's your birthday?
March 4th.
March 4th. And Peter?
November 25th.
Okay, cool. And then do you guys know your spiritual birthdays? Do you remember when you made a decision to follow?
6 years old at my father's guest bedroom bedside. He came home from a conference, explained to me the faith and the best way a six-year-old could try to respond, probably mostly for his dad. But it's funny what God does in those moments. That's when it happened. Absolutely.
I was wrestled with faith for about 2.5, 3 years in high school.
Okay.
I was sitting at a camp. I remember the date, but I remember it was after I graduated, a week or two.
Of high school?
Thursday night, after high school.
Okay.
Thursday night, under a pine tree.
Nice.
On the mountains of Silver Cliff Ranch, Young Life Ranch in Colorado.
Oh, you're fantastic.
I finally just, without any church words, just said, I can't do this by myself.
Beautiful.
If you, Jesus, if you claim to be and who I've learned that you are, then I guess I'm in.
Awesome. This is Guy Talk, and we'd love some questions or issues or concerns. Let us know, 877-933-2484. It's the text line. Again, 877-933-2484. Be right back. Welcome back to Guy Talk. Awfully glad to be joined in the studio by Dr. Peter Kapsner and Tiger McClune, and we're talking about all kinds of stuff. Let us know what subject or question you have for us. We'd love to talk about it. Coming at you from a biblical guy angle. I think that's kind of an interesting combination. Tiger, during the break, you were talking about Acts 2:12. Do say more about that.
Okay. Well, it's become almost my life verse to the journey. Acts 2:12, God shows up in a miraculous way. And Acts 2:12 pops into the passage, and it says, "Amazed and perplexed, they asked one another, 'What does this mean?'" And I love that because, number one, God showed up, and there was an amazement. There was a surprise, caught them totally off guard. And in our faith journey, there'll be moments like that where God breaks through. I call it a sacred memory, where our consciousness is touched by the reality of God. It doesn't solve the doubt, but it supersedes the doubt. And it becomes real. So they experience that amazement. But I love the second phrase, perplexed, which, you know, in the Greek simply means perplexed. I mean, it's just there's no fancy term. It's just confused. They couldn't sort it out. We would like to do, in America today, we want to preach that sermon, a three-point sermon that makes total sense. To them, the movement of God was very confusing. And then the part I like, too, is they didn't try to just sit down and figure it out. They turned to one another and said, what does that mean? And that's part of authenticity, I think, is having the relationships where I can turn to someone and go, that's not making any sense to me, but I'd like to get your input on this because that's how God works, through community. So a simple verse, amazed and perplexed, they ask one another, what does that mean?
Mm. I love it.
Yeah, I love that phrase, sacred memory, because you talk about how that just sort of pushes into the doubt that we so often have, and it made me think of sort of that invitation that the Israelites often had to create these Ebenezers, or these monuments of remembrance,
yes,
that when God was faithful in a moment, whether it was parting a Jordan River or something along those lines, they were invited to just pause and stop and build some kind of physical representation monument, because how quickly the next day, right?
We
forget how God, being faithful in the past, will continue to be faithful in the present and in the future. And I think there's ways we can do that in our life, that that sacred memory, as it's pressed into us, can be physically represented. And I think about my wife did something brilliant with our kids at a very early age, where she had their grandfather make them this God box thing.
Oh, yeah.
And so every year at their birthday, they get a physical representation of something related to the last year, and they put it in their God box. And it's funny watching the kids, sometimes they'll go open up their God box and they will remember a way in which God moved in this last year, just by whether it was a rock or whether it was a candle or something given to them. And boy, I could really use a God box very often, because I have sort of spiritual amnesia on a daily basis about how God was faithful yesterday, while I'm in my worry and my doubt today.
Well, you join the history of humanity. We have spiritual amnesia a lot, which is why the Bible is filled with the word remember.
Yeah.
Remember this. Don't forget what God has done. Pass these things on to your children. And I think that sacred memory is part of that. I think you're exactly right, that remembering it, noticing it, talking about it, remembering it is essential to our faith story, so that even when I describe Thursday night under a tree in Colorado when I was 18 years old, that's a powerful sacred memory in my memory bank that I've had to go back to. There are other ones, hopefully, and the story of people's faith, if you listen to it, will be not that every day with Jesus is sweeter than the day before, because that doesn't work, but there are moments that we remember God's faithfulness. And remembering those are part of the rock, part of the assurance that we need to hold on to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like maybe that's part of why communion would be such an important practice, right? Mm-hmm. We're the very heart of that when you talk about the Bible using the word remember so often. Mm-hmm. I mean, the heart of communion is do this in remembrance of me, and that time each week to just sit back and pause and remember the kingdom of which you are a part because of the work that Jesus did on the cross and that tomb being empty, that brings a place of anchoring in the midst of the weekly turmoil in which I find myself.
Yeah, each week, or if you're a Baptist or evangelical, once a month.
Yeah, once a month, right. Yeah. You know, Tiger, I don't know about you, but I was always most concerned as a kid about dropping the grape juice tray as it went by. And I tried to get the one in the middle.
I grew up Catholic, where it's body Christ by that point. So if it drops, you're in serious trouble
at that point.
Yeah, so
sure.
I'm really nervous. You get really nervous.
I caught one as an altar boy, and I was the altar boy of the month because of that save.
Did they recruit you for the hockey team?
there's a little plaque up with my name on it. Okay, let's talk about men and self-control.
Self-control?
Yeah. Do you think men have a more difficult time with self-control? If you do a comparative analysis
between... That's a stupid question.
I agree. You got to know I'm out of material at this point. You're not going to like the next one either if you don't like this one.
Yeah, we need to riff on this one for about 20 minutes then. My first thought is I don't know about self-control. I would say that... I regularly see that my wife and some of the women around me in this world seem to be more self-sacrificing. And I'm not sure if that is coming from a place of, I don't need to somehow satisfy my existing desire right in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is an element of self-control that comes with that. I would say that to the extent that I observe self-control in men, it's usually because there's some sort of social or vocational boundary that prevents them from acting out on whatever that might be. And so I think it can be a practice, but Boy, self-control when it's only because there's external boundaries around you, I think is very different than the self-control that we're invited to in the biblical text, that you have something going on in your heart that you don't need a bunch of boundaries to have self-control. It just is part of who what your character is.
Yeah. I guess I'm not sure if men have more issues with self-control, but I do think it's true that when self-control is simply because of boundaries or fear of consequences, that's one level of self-control. But when it's an internal, God-designed or God-oriented willingness to control my own intentions and desires and actions, then that's pretty healthy. And I think part of the maturing of any person is moving in the direction that our behavior is guided not by what I think other people will think, but by what I think God wants me to be or do. And that's valid. It's a struggle.
Mm-hmm. All right. Another question you're going to probably find interesting. I'll direct this to start with towards Peter. Why do men and women view sex so differently?
Okay. I have to leave.
Yeah, that's... You know, we talk a little bit about that in the sexuality class that I teach, that there really is there's a genetic hardwiring aspect of the whole thing. That's for sure, in terms of men and women, in terms of what seems to be at the heartbeat of that sexual intimacy. And for women, my understanding is that the primary patterns, as they've been studied, is that women really desire the relationship and they desire intimacy, and that sexual intimacy experience really brings that relational piece together. And that actually, if a woman is simply just touched on their shoulder, there is a bonding chemical called oxytocin that's released throughout a woman's system. That just a simple touch on the shoulder is about the same amount for a male at the point of sexual intimacy is released then. So women are really hardwired and geared for relationship and intimacy as part of the sexual experience and really bring that beautiful reality into it. For men, it's often more of a self-defining kind of experience. It is, I am seen, you do value me, some of those kinds of questions. And so they're just coming even from a biological standpoint from a different place, but the two of them coming together in that way is really a beautiful experience when it's rightly ordered. When it's wrongly ordered, as it often is in a university setting, you know, you'll hear men maybe trying to go to a party or something along those lines. And I went to a state school. I saw so much of this as I was part of a baseball team and all of what would happen. And men would sort of be almost on the hunt. It's a terrible way to talk about it, but it was true that they'd be on the hunt to somehow define themselves through some kind of sexual experience that weekend. And if they did have a sexual experience that weekend, usually the talk between the women would say, so what does that mean for the relationship moving forward? And for the man, there was almost this congratulatory kind of thing that would happen. So there's, you know, when that biological difference gets sort of attached to some really wrongly ordered values, it gets really ugly really fast.
Yeah. Let me throw this out. I heard this in a movie years and years and years ago, and the line was this, and it stuck with me. Men love women they're attracted to, and women are attracted to men they love.
Yeah, I think that describes it, doesn't it?
Maybe it does. I'm just wondering.
The phrase I heard, women often will use love to get... No, men use love to get sex. Women use sex to get love. Mm. You know, again, it's that different orientation of what their primary needs are.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. I was going to say, Tiger, and in light of that, too, I think there's sort of a subtle danger that can happen in marriages where, because of what you described, and how did you say it, men...
use love to get sex.
Yeah.
And women will use sex to try to, you know, get love.
Yeah. And I think on the male side of that equation, some of the subtle danger that might exist is that a man might be desiring sex and just sex itself, not actually intimacy with his wife, but just the sexual act itself. Mm-hmm. And then maybe on a day after 3 months of not really paying attention to their wife or, you know, really being present to them, suddenly they wake up that morning and they desire sex and decide to begin to romance their wife with a card or flowers or some text or something like that, but they're actually desiring sex, not the relationship itself. And I think that gets pretty, you know, that can be pretty dicey in a married relationship pretty fast. Although rightly ordered, that can be a beautiful thing between two people as well.
Yeah. Is there a difference between leadership and authority in the house? Leadership and authority. Is there a difference?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've talked about that from a few different angles, maybe a couple of times here, just that could you have a position of leadership but really not have authority that's rightly ordered at all? Mm-hmm. And I think to be authoritative is to be able to speak things that are consistently true with the kingdom, whether you have a position of leadership or not. And so I would say that to just give somebody authority because they have a place of leadership, boy, in any, whether it's family, whether it's in an institution, I mean, sometimes mm-hmm. you have to, right? You're sort of forced to, but there's a whole lot of people, I'm guessing, that are not authoritative, even though they have a place of leadership. And I think there's a lot of people that have authority that don't have a title to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about leadership in terms of power? I mean, I think there's a difference between power and authority.
Mm-hmm.
Power is taken. So I grab power. I try to assume power, whereas authority is given. Someone trusts you, so they give you authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue men have worked too hard too often to get power in the family and not earn the right to have authority in their family, spiritual or relational mm-hmm. authority, with their kids, in a co-relationship with their wife. They have mutual authority and mutual submission. But power is very different, and mm-hmm. I think we've too often relied on power, not on the hard work of earning authority.
Okay, so in a Christian home, the idea would be that the whole family would be giving authority to the father.
Yeah,
to both parents.
To both, of course. But if there's going to be spiritual leadership mm-hmm. in the household, is it important for the man to be the spiritual leader?
Yeah, well, I think there's different churches that have different yeah. views on that yeah. subject, of course. But within that view of the male leadership, I think that there is certainly some kind of unique authority provided to the male within that view that does need to be paid attention to. But at the same time, it goes back to something we said earlier in the show, that whatever power and authority you have within the economy of the kingdom is used on behalf of others, not for self-gain or for self-satisfaction. And so the kingdom flies upside down compared to the kingdoms of this world mm-hmm. in the sense that when you have authority in the kingdoms of this world, you use it to keep getting more authority and more power and gain for yourself. But within the model of the male being the spiritual leader of the family, whatever power and authority they might have is used expressly for the sake of other people.
Yeah, and that's a huge difference. That's, again, the difference between the power where it's for my benefit and I increase my power versus authority where I use it to serve other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the authority is an earned right that I would argue men need to take more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the earning part of it. Not just that it's mine.
Yeah.
You're supposed to give it to me.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating when Jesus spoke in the synagogue and they said all were amazed and he spoke with an authority, but they couldn't figure out why because he was simply a carpenter's son.
Yes.
And so he had an earned authority about him that wasn't because of the title, position, or fancy robes that he was wearing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to squeak this question in before we go to break. A listener just chimed in with, how do you encourage a Christian man to want to have that authority, that leadership in the home? Sounds like maybe this person doesn't want it or is not longing for it.
Yeah, I think the worst approach would be to tear them down and try to tell them how insufficient they are with it, but to be able to say, hey, there's an opportunity ahead of you, and I want to walk with you to learn what this might be. I'm with you in this as opposed to, you're terrible at doing what you're doing. Why don't you suck it up and do it?
Mm-hmm.
So for a person who maybe is feeling a bit insecure, doesn't necessarily want to go that direction, to know that the person is for them and walking it out, I think is a very helpful first step to say, hey, I know this isn't going to be easy. I know we're probably going to have to figure a lot of stuff out, but let's do this together. I think mm-hmm. feels very invitational versus, hey, why don't you get your act together and finally lead this family?
Right.
So,
by the way, you said that to me. I took that really personal.
Well, you know, there's a little prophetic word in there for
you.
I mean, what am I going to do?
You got these eyes looking at me. All right, let me take a little break. More Guy Talk when we return. Dr. Peter Kapsner and Tiger McClune are in studio. We'll love to hear your question or whatever issue you'd like us to grapple with, 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. Be right back. Welcome back. The Big Hand is on the 48, 12 minutes till the top of the hour. We're enjoying Guide Talk with Tiger McClune and Dr. Peter Kapsner. We were just right before the break chatting about a man and his authority and leadership in the home. And Tiger, during the break, you had some insightful thoughts.
Well, as you talked about the last person asking about a guy who might be a little hesitant or resistive.
How do you encourage a Christian man to want to have that authority and leadership in the house?
I would throw out that the most likely reason why a guy is either resistive or fearful or not stepping up to that plate is a feeling of inadequacy, which is a real non-male quality that in the image. So they feel inadequate to the image of, if I'm going to acknowledge and be a part of leading the family, I must be at this place spiritually. I must be at this. We must do these behaviors. It's got to look like that. And then that guy may be comparing his reality, his own faith journey, his own Bible knowledge, his own sense of what being a leader in the family looks like to that image. And inadequacy is a powerful feeling that we don't know how to talk about. And so often it just creates inertia to not do anything. Yeah. So pay attention. The best person to encourage them, as you said, Peter, that pay attention to what inadequacy is like, and what could we do to help them have a safe place to talk about that.
Yeah, I could say for me for sure, and 365 days a year, that there's far more days of I really don't know for sure what to do versus hey, I've got this. And, you know, that's maybe one out of every 30 days that I feel like I've sort of got a handle on this thing. So to encourage in the midst of inadequacy, that as we talked about earlier in the show, when you're living an inauthentic life, which is sort of the common way to live life, then to come out and say, hey, I really don't know what to do moving forward, that can be a really risky, vulnerable place.
And what would be most helpful to all guys, but I think certainly a person like this, would be to find a safe place with another guy, or maybe a mentor relationship where you can say, you know, let's be honest. What does that mean to be the spiritual leader in my home? I know I've got the guilt that I'm not doing it, but I don't even know what it would look like. What behaviors go along with that so that I don't feel guilty and inadequate anymore because I am now. What does that look like? And I don't think we guys have that kind of conversation. What does that look like? I mean, I tell you, let's be honest. I feel like when I look back, I don't think I was enough of a spiritual leader. Because I can have these things in my head that tick off examples of what that is. Other times other people might say, well, you were in this way, but it's that perception, self-perception, that sucks the life out of us of, I don't know what that means, or I can't live up to the image, or I just feel like a failure in that regard.
Yeah, I think the pressure, especially for young parents and young fathers in particular, who are simply out trying to make ends meet and just trying to hold on to that job and put food on the table, you know, in that kind of a role, if they hold that role for the family, and then to turn and also have the spiritual wisdom, insight, and authority for their kids at the same time. Boy, that is, that's a hard tension to hold that requires almost sort of some maturity. So are we even asking of our young men even the right things, especially if they said, or they don't, as you've said, Tiger, don't have mentors to walk them along the way. You know, you think about, we don't have these father-grandfather relationships in our country anywhere near like we've had historically. And so young men at 28 to 32 sort of thrown to the wolves of parenting, spiritual leadership, trying to figure out jobs. There's just not a lot of guidance there along the way.
They've often not been apprenticed into spiritual growth.
Right.
And so I see more and more when I do parenting seminars of both men and women, but men more so, where they're 35, 40, 45, and they really haven't grown spiritually an inch since high school, if they were honest. I mean, depth-wise, they're very little different than they were. Now they're in a 37-year-old body with more responsibility and a sense of, I ought to do something spiritual, but I have no idea what to do. Yeah. I don't know how to pray out loud. I don't know where to find that in the Bible. Nothing's fresh. And so there is a desire and a responsibility that stirs it, but below that is a sense of feeling spiritually inadequate. Mm-hmm. And I think we in the church have to not berate that, but not pretend that's not true.
Right.
Because there are a whole lot of people who have good intentions spiritually, but haven't been growing much in the last 10, 12 years of their lives, if they're honest.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we meet them there with grace, but also challenge, rather than just give them this image that's like at the, you know, 10-yard line almost for touchdown, and they're back at the beginning going, how do I start? I don't even know where to start.
Mm-hmm. So men make other men better.
I think that's true.
Yeah, I think for sure. And I mean, Tiger, as you were talking, I was thinking it's one thing to say, hey, you should be a better father. But if you are not giving people the tools and putting them in the kind of environment to become that kind of person, and that environment does involve other men. It involves mm-hmm. people who have walked through the struggles and the pain and the turmoil and all of what's there to be along the way. Then we're simply telling our younger people, hey, you know, suck it up, be a better father, without giving them the tools by which to do that.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think I've ever, you know, been in a formal where someone was spiritually mentoring me. But when I look back on my own story, Tom and Carol and probably Terry and Jan, four or five years older than me, early on when I was a husband and figuring that out. And then 5 years later, we had a kid, and they're further down the road. And that relationship and that modeling and just being able to ask them, how do you do that? You know, watching them parent, watching them, you know, going to church mm-hmm. with them and being able to be authentic with them was powerfully shaping for me. Without that, the American individualism is killing us yep. as families. This idea that we're supposed to just build this home and read the Bible and pray in our home and do it all by ourselves is just killing us. But mm-hmm. I think I look back and think, if it weren't for Tom and Carol in yep. particular, I wouldn't have known half of what I know. And I still didn't know much, but I had an example near me of someone I respected, and they modeled it for me. Mm-hmm. We need more apprentice relationships like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. I'm haunted by a conversation I had maybe 10 years ago in a church setting in which I was asking some of the pastoral staff. I said, so where are your 18 to 22-year-olds sort of in the church body? And I think we all know from the statistics that they're rarely in church. And the pastor said, you know, in today's day and age, basically, to paraphrase, it would be weird if they were still here among us. They've been invited to kind of go spread their wings as individuals in the world and kind of go figure it out on their own. And I just, you know, you begin to actually really think about that statement a little bit. We're asking 18, 19, 20-year-olds to just go out there and not be able to apprentice in life. That does set us up for a lot of repair work along the way yeah. into the future.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love pastors, but that's a stupid statement. You know, I mean, I work with teenagers that's just killing them spiritually. Mm-hmm. And when we acknowledge that as okay, the drifting of our youth in their late adolescence is extended, and emerging adulthood is expanding. And what that tells us is we're just saying spiritually, we're going to let you be ill-equipped and unprepared and disconnected, and that's just fine. My argument would be those are the statistics, but yeah. we shouldn't be okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Been a great hour.
Yeah.
I mean, we kind of flew through this.
Yeah. Yeah. 56 and a half after already.
Yeah.
But, you know, and but that word, Tiger, I appreciate that piece of it so much. I do think there's an invitation in here somewhere, right, to just think about how can we apprentice people for life in some different kinds of ways now mm-hmm. that we've sort of lived out these last 15, 20 years of just extreme individualism of go find yourself, go figure yourself out. And all of the empowerment behind that, what would it mean to start developing places in which young people and older people can start getting connected and conversation?
Intergenerational connections
pretty powerful.
Is the key.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're struggling with leadership in the family,
right.
I wonder if the men have good, strong male friendships where you can get together and talk honestly and authentically about real adult topics.
Yeah. And then when you're not alone at 11:30 at night and you're the last one awake in your family and you're wondering, what am I going to do tomorrow and how am I going to make it? You're suddenly not alone. That even if you don't connect with that other man or those men in your life, you know that they're there. And somehow that brings a little bit different peace and stability in the midst of the really difficult questions.
All right. I'll throw one real quick last thing out there.
All right.
And then we can pick it up another time. And that is that church spirituality is built around female, which is we sit in a circle, we look each other in the eye, we use noun verbs, and we share feelings. Men don't do that for the most part.
Yeah.
We communicate as we're doing something else.
That's
talk
true.
Together,
true
do
thing.
Stuff
yeah.
together, golf together, fish together, whatever right. the activity is. And then while the activity is going on, then I'm feeling comfortable. I turn to my side and I see him and I talk to him.
Yeah. Well, I got to clean up the chips and salsa and get the Nerf footballs out of here because Guy Talk is officially now ending. And then the beautiful and amazing Queens of the Round Table are up next, also known as Girl Talk. That's all ahead of the next hour. Thanks to Dr. Peter Kapsner and Tiger McClune for coming into the studio for Guy Talk. Loved having you here.
Thank you
so much. And we'll look forward to the next time. We'll take a short break and be back with Hour 2 in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.